Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the problem of maritime piracy, something that has been increasing over the last 10 years or so, but has been particularly significant over the last couple of years, and in one place in particular. That is in the Gulf of Aden and off the east coast of Somalia. This year, the total number of pirate attacks has already passed the number for all of 2008. There's also been an increase in the number of ships fired upon in this region. In this hour of Focus, we'll try to talk a little bit about contemporary piracy and what nations around the world are doing or perhaps can do to try to fight it. And we have two guests with us, joining us both by telephone. Eugene Kontrovich is Associate Professor of Law at Northwestern University. His interests include international law, and this particular issue, that is piracy, maritime piracy, and how nations respond is one of the things that he has thought about and written about. Before he went to law school, he also worked as a reporter, editorialist, and editor at several leading New York and national papers, and continues to occasionally provide commentary in the press. Also joining us is Admiral Kevin Cosgriff. He is now the Vice President for Business Development and Strategy at ATK. That's an aerospace and defense company. He is a retired naval officer. He retired at the rank of Vice Admiral. He did a number of things while he was in the Navy. He was commander of U.S. Naval Forces in Central Command and also commander of the U.S. Fifth Fleet. He served on a number of ships. He also served as analyst at the Defense Intelligence Agency National Military Intelligence Center, and also was director of the White House Situation Room and director of Systems and Technical Planning for the National Security Council. Both of them have done a lot of thinking and have commented on this issue, and we're glad that they could spend a little time with us this morning talking about it. Questions from listeners are also welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is that people try to keep their questions, comments brief, so we can keep moving along. Questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, feel free to use that number. And that is 800-222-9455. So again, 333 here in Champaign-Urbana, if you are here where we are. And a toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here. Certainly, questions are welcome. Professor Kontrovich, hello.
Hello, Kevin. Hello, David. Good to be here with you.
And thank you also, Admiral Cosgriff, for talking with us.
David, it's good to be here.
Maybe I'll start with you, as I believe that you have experience having served in this region. One of the things, as I mentioned, that we know is that maritime piracy, let us say over about the last decade, has been on the increase, and the last couple of years have been particularly bad. And this place in particular, this region in particular, has been the focus of a lot of attacks. I wonder, do you have some thoughts about, first of all, why it is that we've seen this increase in maritime piracy, but particularly why it is this region has seen so many attacks?
Well, I think the obvious reason for the increase is the lack of a stable environment inside Somalia, where young men in particular and the clans for whom they are affiliated can find real work that through which they can sustain themselves and their families and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That said, piracy pays, or at least piracy in East Africa, Northeast Africa pays, and without making excuses, it's violent criminal activity, but nonetheless, it does pay, and I believe that's why they're doing it.
Yeah. Professor Kontrovich, I think one of the things I know that you've written about is that, and we can talk about this some more, that countries around the world, it seems that they've been reluctant to deal with this as aggressively as perhaps they might. I think the other thing that we know is that shipping companies, while they may be end up paying significant amount of money in ransom as a part of their total operations, you know, maybe they just write that off as a cost of business. So it seems that it's something that, in fact, business and government has said, well, we'll do the minimum that we have to do to deal with this, and maybe hasn't been as aggressive as they could.
So the form of government of the countries around the world has been inconsistent and in some sense incoherent. Look, I wouldn't say it's not aggressive. A large number of ships have been sent to the region. It's a very costly effort. Some of the leading navies have many ships. Our Navy has sent ships off from counterterrorism duty to be patrolling the Gulf of Aden for piracy, and they are serious about trying to find the pirates and catch them. The irony is that upon catching the pirates, there seems to be no interest in prosecuting them for a variety of reasons which we could discuss. So while they are, and it's hard to see what the point of being aggressive about catching pirates is if you are going to put them back into the water, which is what many countries are now doing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's this reluctance to prosecute is because of the apparent or perceived difficulties in bringing such a case. Nobody really wants to have it in their court, clogging up their court, and no one wants to deal with the difficulties. But in that case, it really reduces the benefit of stopping them in the first place.
Yeah. Let me just take a moment here to reintroduce our guests and also to give the telephone number to people who are listening here. We have two. Eugene Kontorovich is Associate Professor of Law at Northwestern University, international law, one of his specialties, and he's done some writing on the issue of piracy and how it is that nations have responded to the problem of piracy. Also joining us is Admiral Kevin Cosgriff. He's a retired naval officer, retiring at the rank of a vice admiral, has had a long career in the Navy, including some experience in the region that we're talking about. Currently, he serves as a vice president for business development and strategy at ATK. That's an aerospace and defense company. Questions certainly are welcome. We want to invite people who are listening into the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. Well, let me, I want to get back here to Professor Kontorovich. And one of the things I know that you have written, one of the papers that I read, or perhaps it was an article, that where you said that you were talking about how uncommon it is for nations to actually try the people, the pirates that they catch. It has happened. And it looks like it's going to happen here in the United States. But one of the things that you wrote is that the rarity of these cases highlights, in your words, the complete failure of international law as a response to piracy. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, piracy has a very special status in international law, a status which would make one think it would be very well suited to this kind of international enforcement effort to an international legal solution. Piracy is a crime for which universal jurisdiction exists. That means any country can prosecute any pirates it catches. Now, it's also the first universal jurisdiction crime. It's been a universal jurisdiction crime for hundreds of years. And to give people some perspective, universal jurisdiction has in recent decades become an idea which people talk about using for other kinds of crimes, human rights offenses, war crimes, torture. If people might recall the Pinochet case, in Britain, was a Spanish attempt to prosecute General Pinochet of Chile for things he did in Chile. So there's this idea that international law, as it's growing in strength, this concept of universal justice for crimes which threaten the entire world, for crimes that hurt everybody in some sense, is becoming more of a reality. There's this sense amongst international lawyers. People say that we're coming closer towards a system of international justice. So in the system of international justice, universal jurisdiction for piracy is the ground floor. It's the most basic because it's a very simple crime. It doesn't have political overtones. And the countries now, and it's a perfect crime for universal jurisdiction because when countries patrolling the Gulf of Aden catch a group of Somalis who appear to be pirates, they weren't necessarily just attacking a ship of the country that caught them. So if there's a Canadian warship, it gets a distress call from an Indian ship, and it catches some pirates trying to attack the Indian ship, universal jurisdiction addresses specifically that situation. And it doesn't need to be an Indian ship that catches the pirates. It can be a Canadian ship, and the Canadians can put them on trial. However, this doctrine of universal jurisdiction has been used exactly zero times by the nations patrolling in the Gulf of Aden. And the only couple cases in which pirates have been brought for trial is when they attacked the ships of the capturing nation. So, for example, America does plan to try the pirate that attacked a U.S.-flagged vessel. But that's not going to result in many cases, because there are very few U.S.-flagged vessels. Similarly, France is trying some pirates which attacked a French vessel. But much more frequently, they release or return to Somalia pirates that they catch when they didn't attack French vessels. And that's what I mean by suggest a certain immaturity of international law, because international law currently aspires to be able to use universal jurisdiction over much more difficult, much more politically fraught offenses, war crimes, crimes against humanity, things which usually arise in very complicated geopolitical contexts. But if you can't really apply it to piracy, it's kind of like trying to prosecute political corruption cases, to try to have an independent counsel in a system where the DA can't even bring a robbery case.
Well, one of the things that apparently has occurred is that the EU and Britain and the United States have entered into agreements with Kenya to try Somali pirates there. That apparently they cannot take them reliably to Somalia for them to be tried. So, and perhaps it's there are problems with taking them back to the home countries. Perhaps even if it's one of their own flagships, would it help to, in a sense, set up a pirate court if you could find a third, conveniently located third country that was willing to do this, like Kenya, for example, or maybe someplace else in Africa?
So the idea of a pirate court in theory is not a bad one, though I think it's very difficult to realize for the very same reasons that it would be difficult to, that nations don't want to exercise jurisdiction. The idea of an international court, you need to look behind the label. Well, you might have an international court, but the enforcement officers, the jails, the bailiffs, the corrections officials, the judges, they're all going to have to belong to some country. Now, we do have an agreement now to transfer people we catch to Kenya. This agreement is very problematic. For one, Kenya does not have a very great human rights record. As a matter of fact, the United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur for Kenya issued a very damning report just a few months ago, just as this agreement was being signed, suggesting that the Kenyan Attorney General, judicial officials, many law enforcement officials are involved in a variety of crimes, including massive killings of people. So this sounds like the kind of rendition to countries with poor human rights records which was controversial in the case of, say, Guantanamo detainees. It's not controversial in this case, interestingly. That is to say, it hasn't made a big public uproar. I don't understand why. It's an interesting thing, because you'd think, actually, if anything, pirates deserve more solicitude than suspected terrorists. But the Kenyan thing is limited. And the other way it's limited is Kenya does not want an infinite amount of pirates. Kenya has already begun to say that they have agreed to take some, but they're not going to take all the pirates of Somalia. Their courts are already very clogged. Their jails are very clogged, and they don't want to be a pirate repository. So there's going to be a big NIMBY problem here, right? A not-in-my-backyard problem. Mm-hmm. Nobody really wants to house lots of pirates. And wherever you have this international pirate court, there's going to have to be a pirate jail, and that pirate jail is not going to be international because it has to be in some nation. And we've already seen with the Guantanamo detainees, there's much pressure from European countries to have them released or transferred to some third country, but nobody wants to be that third country. And I think you're going to see the same thing with terrorists. So unless nations individually decide to step up and prosecute their fair share, so to speak, of pirates, I think the problem is not going to be easily solved by the Kenyan expedient.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to come back to Admiral Cosgrave and ask you a different kind of question. It is my understanding that on Monday, the Commandant of the Coast Guard signed a new maritime security directive that would require U.S. flagships who are sailing around the Horn of Africa, so in the kind of places we're talking about, to have guards on board. And apparently this gives the ship owners the choice of deciding whether these would be armed guards or not, and it doesn't say things like how many there should be and how they should be trained. But it does lead me to the question, and I think people have raised this question before, whether one solution or part of the solution here would be to either arm the crews of the ships that might be attacked or have trained armed security personnel on the ships so that if they're attacked by pirates, they can fight them off. And I wonder what it is. What do you think about that? The idea of either, you know, putting armed guards on the boats or arming the crews.
Well, I have not been a proponent of that approach worldwide. It may work in a country like the United States or Great Britain or Japan or something like that, which has good rule of law, good control over how you would train and certify these people and that sort of thing. But as your listeners may or may not know, there's many ships registered under so-called flags of convenience. The owner might be in country A, and the flag is registered via a shell corporation in a small s, not the company, a front corporation in another country, such as Panama, Liberia, and the like. And it sails under that flag, and it's going to have a mixed nationality crew. So, yes, it may work for the good, strong rule of law maritime nations. It's going to be very problematic for the rest of the vast majority of the merchant fleet.
Yeah. Professor Kontroich, are there particular legal problems posed by that idea? That is, you arm the crews or put armed guards aboard these boats, and if they're attacked, they defend themselves. Is there a clear right for them to do that?
There's no legal prohibition in international law from crews defending themselves. It's not particularly well spelled out, but the right of self-defense is considered in international law an inherent right, and certainly the crews have a right of self-defense. What might be, as a historical matter, what might turn out to be problematic, the way pirates have always operated, the reason pirates have been successful in previous eras, in the age of sail, in the 18th century, in the 17th century, is because crews have never had a very strong incentive to resist. So even in the age when merchant ships were routinely armed and carried a small number of cannon, the people on the ship, they don't own the ship, they don't own the cargo, they're just getting paid, and they don't have the strongest incentive to put their life on the line, especially against a group of pirates who are willing to really risk it all. So you could presumably hire very trained security contractors, which would be expensive. But the problem of incentives might also prove to be a difficult one. And in the end, it might be always easier and preferable for the crew to surrender.
Well, I suppose that does indeed get back to the point that as far as the ship owners are concerned, they want to minimize damage to the ship. I would hope that they're concerned with the safety of the crew. And that might indeed explain why it is that if a ship is taken, that they're willing to enter into a negotiation with the people who took it, pay some sort of ransom, and if everybody comes out of this okay, the pirates get some money, the ship owners get their ship back, the crew is not harmed, that one could see where ship owners might think, well, we'd rather not have to do this, but if that's what we have to do, that's what we'll do. We'll pay however much they ask, or we'll go into some negotiations and arrive at a figure that they will accept and we can live with. We give them the money and then we go on. It's maybe not surprising that a ship owner would take that kind of position.
It's exactly like a protection racket. So the mob goes around to people and says, give us money or we'll burn down your store. And the ship owners are in a similar position with regards to the ship. We don't routinely say that private individuals, it's up to them to fight off the mob. We expect private individuals, when they're shaken down by the mob, they're going to pay. And that's what the ship owners are doing. There's a relatively small chance of any individual ship being captured, and in the end you can always pay. So to think that the ship owners have the obligation, the primary obligation, to deal with this problem seems at odds with how we generally think about law enforcement.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Someone here in Urbana, where we are. It's line one. Let's do that. Hello.
Hello. I would suggest that the primary method to a remedy for this situation isn't so much arming the vessels as it is to rectify the situation in Somalia. For decades now, the Europeans have been dumping garbage into their waters and have destroyed their fishing. The large internationally owned trawlers have completely depleted the surrounding seas of saleable fish. And poor Somalia has been left without one of its few primary resources. And I suggest that enforcement of anti-dumping and protection of the natural resources would go a long way toward allowing the nation to rebuild its infrastructure. That and the fact that the great nations have been using it as a battleground for the past 40 years. But that's just my comment.
Well, all right. Professor Gontarovich, do you want to comment on that?
I would love to. I think everyone would agree that the situation would be much better if Somalia had a stable democratic government committed to the rule of law, as opposed to four or five or six feuding clans, factions, religious segments, combined with international forces, duking it out. I think everyone would agree that would be better. How to make it so is very difficult, as I think any of the five, six, seven groups fighting for control of Somalia would tell you. They're all trying to restore government to Somalia, and none of them are having any success. I think that's very difficult. I think everyone agrees that would be the first best. It's not so obvious how to do. I think there's probably a very strong reluctance amongst Americans to send ground troops to do nation building in Somalia, given the famous Black Hawk Down episode, which could easily be repeated. As for the root causes of piracy argument, I'm glad the listener brought this up. I like to say that there are two accounts, two deep accounts, or narratives, as people might want to call them, of the Somali piracy phenomenon. There's a right-wing account, and there's a left-wing account. So the right-wing account, of course, says the Somali pirates, they're in with the terrorists. They're in with Al-Qaeda. It's about terrorism. And there's a little bit of truth to this. Some truth, hard to say how much. And the left-wing account, as I call it, is the idea that we have to think about the root causes of piracy, and really they are fending off foreign predation of their shipping waters. And there's a little bit of truth to that, too. But I think you don't need to look too deeply into root causes to figure out this mystery. The average, the per capita income in Somalia is about $600 a year. Average guy might be making $300 a year. It was never that much higher in the good old days. And so when you have a vessel goes by and you can get $1 million in one day by attacking it, it doesn't take any deep theories to understand why that will become appealing to people. And there has always been Somali piracy. It's gone back quite a while. There's been a big spike, I think. There are many reasons, partially the collapse of the government, but also I think they've worked out a better business model with the ransoms than what they used to do, which was try to take the stuff off the ship and sell it. You show up in Somalia, you say, this fell off the back of a freighter. So that's not going to get as much money, it turns out, as ransoming the crews back to the shipping lines, and this new business model might help explain why we see more of that. But clearly, if Somalia were Switzerland, there would probably not be Somali pirates.
Yeah. Our guests this morning, let me reintroduce, as we're about our midway through here this hour, Eugene Kontarovich. He's Associate Professor of Law at Northwestern University, and his among his research and teaching interests, international law. He's done some writing on the subject of piracy. And also joining us is Vice Admiral Kevin Cosgrove. He's a retired naval officer. He is now Vice President for Business Development and Strategy at ATK. That's an aerospace Space and Defense Company. He served as commander of U.S. Naval Forces Central Command, commander of the U.S. Fifth Fleet, served aboard a number of ships. He was an analyst at the Defense Intelligence Agency, National Military Intelligence Center, served as executive assistant to the Navy's Director of Strategy and Policy, also was director of the White House Situation Room and director of Systems and Technical Planning for the National Security Council. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to come back to Admiral Cosgrove and get some of your thoughts on these matters here we've been talking about for the last couple of minutes. Apparently, about a month ago, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, says was talking about this particular problem, said he was looking for some new ideas. He said this was a problem that requires more than just a military solution. And I suppose that puts the military in a kind of a difficult position because, you know, military solutions is what the military does. But having said that, I guess I'm wondering what you think about that, and are there things, you know, going beyond military solutions that actually the military could do, or is this a job for diplomats and governments and other folks?
Well, regardless of which narrative, as the professor pointed out, is really operative, this is a crime, a violent crime by organized criminal entities on the high seas, and most of the time such enforcement of laws on the high seas fall to navies or to those coast guards that are robust enough to do it. So it's hard to get away from the dealing with the specific acts of piracy from a military or a naval point of view. I mean, there's a range of things that can be done. You can status quo, which is we've sort of flooded the zone a little bit with these forces operating under the combined maritime forces, which your listeners might be interested to know is commanded by the same commander as the Fifth Fleet and Naval Forces Central Command, and I commanded it when I was there. 22 plus nations contributing ships to combat terrorists and the use of the seas for terror, including narco trafficking. So those additional ships are in the area, and the missions are somewhat compatible. What we have now that we didn't have when I was there is the additional UN action to allow for much more robust response. Mm-hmm. So you can continue what we're doing. It's problematic. We're talking 300,000 to 400,000 square miles of ocean. Big sea, small boat sort of phenomenon, even where the ships get channeled in the Gulf of Aden, it's still difficult to find a small fiberglass craft in the middle of the night with no lights, and you have literally minutes to interrupt an act of piracy. And once they're aboard, it's a hostage situation, and great care needs to be and was and will be taken to safeguard the crew. You can consider arming the ships, and we've already talked about that. You mm-hmm. could consider convoying the ships. I don't think the shipping companies would like that any more than they like the arming idea because it costs them more money, it costs them time, it's a delay, but it certainly is effective. It could be done. Then there's the moving up the scale, there's the go ashore into Somalia light. And by that I mean naval raids to basically hit the pirate camps along the coast and deny them the means of piracy, boats, motors, fuel, etc. And then, of course, if you want to address root causes, you could go ashore heavy. And the difference between light and heavy is that you would be going after the pirate leaders, the clans. You would deny them of the fruits of their labor, seize their property, incarcerate them, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And you can see that, at least in the dialogue I've been following back here in Washington, D.C., there's not a lot of appetite for these sorts of higher-end options.
Just to stay with the point of what would be adequate resources on the water, I know I've taken out my atlas, and other people might have looked at this area, and I suppose on the map it doesn't look all that big. But certainly the point that you've made is that we're talking about a lot of water here, and that at this point the figure that I have is that there are about 30, I think, 30 warships from various countries who are involved in this patrolling. The question would be, well, if we decided we were going to put some – if we had the resources to spare, if we were going to put some more ships into this effort, how many more would it take? And would it, if we had 10 more, or if we had 20 more, or even if we doubled the number – that's probably not possible, but even if we could, would that make a significant difference?
It would certainly have a potential deterrent effect as the pirates see more gray hulls, as we refer to Navy vessels out there, then that might dissuade them from at least a local deterrent type effect. They're going to go away. They're going to turn around and run away. Of those couple dozen ships, at any given time, you probably only have two-thirds or maybe as little as a half actually out patrolling. The nations that send ships there less frequently than the United States will mount the effort to send the ships, but they'll also use those ships as diplomatic tools by visits to ports around the area. So they have other taskings from their government which would take them away from the immediate scene of piracy.
Let me just add here.
Sure.
You can double or triple the number of ships, and you could quadruple them if they're not actually sending the pirates they capture for prosecution, if they're just putting them back in the water, which is the dominant approach now. It doesn't seem to really matter how many ships you have in terms of deterrent effect.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, as Secretary Rice, Condoleezza Rice, when she was Secretary of State and she spoke at the Security Council in December, she said, right now, piracy is consequence-free. And I believe the Chief Admiral of the Coast Guard has made similar statements. Right now, they can expect that the worst thing that happens to them is they'll get a ride back to their port. Maybe some will be sent to Kenya, but none of those prosecutions have actually been completed, and so it's not really clear whether that's going to be a serious venue for prosecuting them. So right now there's very little downside to being a pirate if you don't act stupid and shoot at naval vessels, which is generally how they get hurt. But if you just focus on civilian vessels, there's really not much is going to happen to you. And until that changes, until nations try to become serious about using the legal tools at their disposal, I don't think the pirates will be particularly afraid. As a matter of fact, I write about this in my forthcoming article in the California Law Review called A Guantanamo on the Sea, and one of the epigrams in that article is a quote from a New York Times article where they interviewed a pirate, and he said, they can't stop us. We know international law. And so they know that they're not just going to be blasted out of the water on sight. And they know that nations are unwilling to prosecute them because of some certain difficulties that would involve.
Mm-hmm.
So right now they operate with near impunity. And the principal, and the admiral could correct me, but the principal job of the naval vessels there now is really interdiction, to try to stop them in the act and try to foil attacks in progress rather than really trying to go after them in a more aggressive law enforcement way, like, say, detectives would.
Well, is that the case, Admiral?
I would agree. That is principally the case for any number of reasons, because a small boat on the high seas is not ipso facto a pirate boat.
Hmm.
Now, that said, to mount an effort that goes beyond intervention at the point of piracy is possible. We know how to board ships. We know how to do that. That's a political decision. It's a financial decision of sorts to pay for that effort. That could be done. And then if you do that with an idea of bringing these people to justice, then you probably ought to have people other than your average U.S. Navy sailor, maybe some Coast Guardsmen or other law enforcement type people, to help with evidence gathering and the sorts of things you would need in a court of law, be it Kenya or back in the United States or someplace else.
Just for, well, I have some callers here we get to. I just want to come back and make sure that we've clarified the point. I want to go back to Professor Kontorovich. And you talked earlier about the fact that the piracy, the nature of this crime, the way we think about it is such that if somebody's doing this in international waters, it is considered, in a sense, a crime against everyone. So anybody can apprehend a pirate's attacking any ship, arrest them and try them. There's no legal problem with doing that. But apparently, that nations have been reluctant to do it. For a variety of reasons. Perhaps it's expensive. Perhaps it's difficult. Perhaps it takes a long time. And maybe, in fact, they think that if it's not one of their ships, that it's not worth going to all that trouble. Why is it that countries are so unwilling to do something that clearly they can, legally at least, they can do?
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about what the reasons are, because not only can they legally, but under many views, there's an international legal duty to prosecute piracy. The United Nations, Convention on the Law of the Sea, the Law of the Sea Treaty, to which the United States is a party to the 1958 version, which first codified these rules, says that all nations have a duty to suppress piracy. And it would be hard to interpret catching people and putting them back in the water as suppression. So there's a variety of concerns. First of all, like the Admiral mentioned, there's no crime to be a group of Somalis in a boat with lots of guns. Now, who could those people be? Maybe they're pirates, but they would say they're just honest fishermen looking for fish in the vicinity of a ship that happened to recently be attacked by pirates. So how are you really going to prove that they're pirates? Now, you might say that's a ridiculous argument, but if you think about the Guantanamo detainees who were captured in Afghanistan, the military says they're enemy combatants, many of them said, no, we're just tourists, we're just aid workers, we're just passing through. And those claims were taken very seriously and caused substantial legal difficulties. Also, as the Admiral mentioned, the naval personnel, military personnel, are not trained and probably shouldn't be trained to deal with things that law enforcement personnel do, such as chain of evidence, evidence preservation, reading people their rights. And so you'd need a whole different approach to catching them, because when the military catches people, it is not about generally building a case about them, but about detaining them as prisoners. And to make it even worse, perhaps the pirates will claim that they are entitled to the protections of the Geneva Conventions, which would entail a whole separate set of legal hassles with which we're very familiar from Guantanamo. Now, why would that be? So I mentioned the left-wing and the right-wing narrative. If the right-wing narrative is true and they are auxiliaries of al-Qaeda, so it's Guantanamo all over again. And if the left-wing narrative is true, then they're essentially the ad hoc Coast Guard of Somalia. And though that might seem absurd, the chairman of the African Union has actually described them as such, has given credence to this claim. So in either case, that would open up a huge can of worms. Now, here's the great irony, of course. Pretty much all the issues I mentioned, the unsuitability of military personnel for building legal cases when they capture people, for a military capture to be the beginning of a legal case, the difficulty of having military personnel come and testify. Oh, yeah, testimony would be a whole other problem. Who's going to testify against them? You'd have to get the crew of the ships that they hijacked, who might be halfway around the world. The Geneva Conventions issues, the evidentiary issues, these are, of course, the exact same problems that would arise from trying to try Guantanamo detainees in civilian court. And I think there's a powerful lesson we can learn from the failure of any nation to try to prosecute a pirate in their civilian courts, which is that it is actually not so easy. And a lot of people have been suggesting that it would be very easy to try enemy combatants in civilian courts, the military could figure it out, and the evidence wouldn't be a problem, and it wouldn't be too much of a hassle. So this suggests that in a much more depoliticized context, where we can see these arguments more clearly, that it would indeed be quite difficult. So, and I think those difficulties are real and should not be gainsaid.
All right. We have some callers here. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let us go to the phones to someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm interested that I have not heard juvenile justice come up in this conversation, or really many conversations that I've heard about this. Given that many of these pirates are, in fact, you know, young men who, if they were committing, you know, a crime here in the United States, they would be in the juvenile courts. And I guess I'm interested in hearing your guest's perspective on this, you know, specifically when talking about restorative justice versus, you know, the kind of the high seas mentality, you know, blow them out of the water to, you know, take away the incentive of them being pirates. I mean, I think that those seem to be an extreme contrast to each other, those two perspectives. And so I'm just interested to know if there's, I mean, I kind of sense an irony there, but I'm interested to know if anyone on the show or anyone kind of contributing to the discourse about this has brought that issue up.
Well,
when they captured the surviving pirate from the Alabama hijacking, there was a concern that he was a minor, which could present legal wrinkles. But just to be clear, juveniles who have committed very serious crimes, like hijacking, armed robbery, attempted murder, can and often are tried as adults in the United States, and certainly in many other countries. So if they happen to be 17 or 16, it would not necessarily be a problem trying them for piracy. Problems would arise with the application of the death penalty, for which they probably would not be eligible unless they actually did more than just piracy. So it's a concern. It might look bad if you're trying a 16-year-old Somali kid, but they're not all 16 years old. And the one we've got, for example, isn't 16, and the leaders are certainly significantly older than that. I think maybe in European countries, this might be a bigger problem. Europe has even more restrictive laws, I believe, and I'm not an expert on this, on trying juveniles. So for Europe, this is a big dilemma. Let's say they capture a pirate, and they bring him back, and it turns out he's 17. And the only thing you can do with a 17-year-old is put him in a halfway house. So they might not be comfortable having a Somali pirate in a halfway house, and they basically would have to release him. And so now he's living in Europe. So the concern about releasing the pirates, if something doesn't work out, such as that they're juveniles, is a big part of what keeps nations, I think, from bringing them back from trial. Again, it's another Guantanamo-type concern, right? We have all these people in Guantanamo. If we can't try them, people say we have to release them. Where do they go? There was an idea of transferring them to Leavenworth, but I think the people in the area, the civilians, are not very happy about that. So it's the same kind of concern. And just to give an example, Britain, by the way, and probably other countries, but we know it for sure of Britain. Britain has ordered its navy not to arrest any pirates and to really not to try to even bring them on board Royal Navy ships because they might ask for asylum under European laws. And, of course, the fact being minors would probably make such requests easier. But in America, at least, the fact that you're 17 or 16 would not be a bar to prosecution for piracy.
All right.
One point I'd like to add to is the fact that let's not forget the cynicism of those Klan leaders who undoubtedly are putting young men, 16 years old, 15 years old, 17 years old, into these circumstances. I mean, I take the caller's point. It's an important point worldwide. But let's put the responsibility back in these people who are violent criminal gangs engaged in violent crime on the high seas. They are responsible.
All right. I hope that gets at least in part at the question of the call. Let's continue. We'll talk with someone also in Champaign. Next, line number two.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
A number of years ago, I read an article in Scientific American about hard-shelled dirigibles. And the deal on that is that they're vacuum-filled, so you don't have the instability that you have with gases that expand and contract with temperature. But I'm looking at that and thinking, what a low-cost way of putting an eye in the sky that would give you extra information about piracy or anything else that might be taking place below. And if anyone were to shoot one down, you could check in on the telemetry and see where this kind of action was coming from. I'm going to take my answer off the air, but I thank you very kindly.
All right. Well, I don't know. Admiral Cosgrove, if you have any response to that?
Well, I think the caller identifies an important part of any sort of operation that you'd want to mount out there over time, and that's persistent surveillance and persistence to cover the area that I described is really by air. Mm-hmm. And there's strengths and weaknesses to lighter-than-air vehicles, wingless lighter-than-air vehicles, regardless of hard shell, soft shell. But they are persistent. They could be manned. They could be unmanned. UAVs might have a role in this, but you know, if you're sort of keeping track, you're starting to add up the dollars. And it's important, although I agree with the professor, it's important for people to understand how big a problem is this. There's, what is it, $10, $15 trillion of trade moving on the world's ocean. The consumers of the world have probably paid $10 to $20 billion of increased costs, delays, whatever, because of piracy. And the ship owners have probably paid to date a handful of millions of dollars total in ransom. So, as the professor said, your chances of being hijacked in the Gulf of Aden are quite low, and worldwide even lower. Although I note there's a ship hijacked off Nigeria and is being held hostage today, not for ransom apparently, as for political reasons. But so the problem is abroad in the land, which is one of my concerns about piracy. Is it can be taught and it can be learned, mm-hmm. and that's why taking action here and now is important.
All right. We are going to get at least one more caller here, Champaign County, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. I think there's a whole other show on the future of dirigibles and hot air and helium, but I think it's a bit of a digression here. But so I won't but say that. Well, I wanted to sort of answer the question or continue the question that a previous caller made about the economic dislocation of Somalia, which has a long history and a lot of authors. The expert answered it with lamenting the lack of governance in Somalia, which was, I thought, missing the point. I mean, the caller was talking about toxic dumping and which is against the law of the sea and should be enforced by anybody, as well as much as attacking pirates should be, or dealing with pirates should be. So it's a problem of governance, not just in Somalia, it's for this to happen. One of the speakers also mentioned that the pirates know that they can't just be attacked forthrightly, and they know that there's some law extant. But actually, the Indians apparently set the stage for some caution in that regard, because at a very early time in this whole latest episode, they attacked the wrong ship. They blew it out of the water and killed a bunch of innocent Somali fishermen. Not a lot was made of it. You had a previous program on, or the show has had a previous program with a guy from Monterey Institute who was actually quite good on this and was emphasizing the problem of the lack of governance and the where the source of that was. I always like to cite Augustine's The Pirate and the Emperor, too. I think that's a good thing for people to Google and take it to heart. And just as one parting shot, and I realize this is too much to pile up for the very end of the show, I do gainsay the people that say there are difficulties in prosecuting people in civilian courts. I think that that's what the rule of law demands, and there's even the problem of incarceration is even not perhaps as bad. There's at least one community in a depressed area that has an empty prison who are actually lobbying to have some of the detainees from Guantanamo go there. That's more an indication of economic distress than actual social policy. But I'll ring off and listen to your answers.
All right. Well, let me go to Professor Kontorovich. Can you respond to some of that?
I don't know quite where to start. I think the final comment suggests that there's a duty to prosecute. So it might make – maybe prosecution is something we should do. Maybe it's the right thing to do. Maybe it's what the law requires. But that just means that the benefit outweighs the cost. It doesn't mean that the costs aren't real. And I think nations are seeing more or thinking more about the cost side of the equation.
Professor, Admiral Cosgrave, I'm interested in coming back to you at least for a moment here, just to if you can give some perspective. I would imagine that people who are in the position of being on a naval ship and having to respond to this as best they can must feel and maybe a little bit frustrated about the limitations on what it is that they can do, and the fact that it seems that our so far our main response here, which should be on many levels, the main response here has been essentially a kind of a law enforcement response, and the military people are the ones who are ended up having to carry it out.
Well, the good news is that our sailors and the men and women that lead our sailors are from a rule of law country. We support and defend the Constitution and our oath, and our leaders give us the orders and the rules within which we will carry out those orders, and that's just the way it is. And if there's frustration, it was not apparent to me when I was out there. They took their mission seriously. They went about it in a professional manner. You know, you win some, you lose some when you're hunting pirates. With the increased UN Security Council resolutions and other decisions taken in this country and elsewhere, it's much more proactive, which is much more fulfilling for our sailors. I note that the USS Gettysburg and a Korean ships intervened today to the rescue of an Egyptian ship and have detained 17 pirates. I'd also like the listeners to recall that this is dangerous. These are armed people. They will resist. We are putting our sailors into boats all over that part of the world on a daily basis to search for cargo, search for terrorists, to look in some of these boats on occasion if they meet the profile and see whether they have things or missing things like fishing gear would be a good indication. But you're putting sailors at risk. That's what they signed up to do. They're good at it, and the country ought to be proud of them.
Right. Well, there, we're going to have to leave it. I'm sure we'll come back to this topic in the future, but for the moment, we'll leave it there with our thanks to our guest, Admiral Kevin Cosgrave. He's a retired naval officer. He now serves as Vice President for Business Development and Strategy at ATK. It's an aerospace and defense company. Admiral Cosgrave, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And Eugene Kontorovich, he's Associate Professor of Law at Northwestern University. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.